Hello, my name is Joan Beaucaire of Theocracy Watch, a project of the Center for Religion, Ethics, and Social Policy at Cornell University. Today's date is April 18, 2005. The date's important because events are unfolding so rapidly in the Middle East that by the time you hear this talk, the situation may be different. This talk is called Christian Zionists, Major Players in the Middle East. Some 4,000 years ago, as written in Genesis of the Hebrew Scriptures, God made a promise to Abraham. Now the Lord said to Abraham, "And I will make of thee a great nation." And the Lord appeared unto Abraham and said, "Unto thy seed will I give this land." Christian Zionists believe the modern state of Israel is part of the divine plan based on God's promise to Abraham. Lord Arthur Balfour of Great Britain was a Christian Zionist. As England's Foreign Secretary in 1917, he wrote the Balfour Declaration, which stated, "His Majesty's government views with favor the establishment in Palestine of a national home for the Jewish people." Christian Zionists are major players in the Middle East, and yet they're almost never mentioned in the news. Modern-day Christian Zionists believe Israel has a crucial role to play in bringing on the second coming of Christ. So in order for that to happen, they have been very active for the past 25 years in expanding the boundaries of the State of Israel to permanently include all of the West Bank. We will demonstrate how Christian Zionists have been actively shaping events in the Palestinian territories beginning in the year 1978. Before we talk about their activities, we're going to go over some background information relevant to two events that Christian Zionists see as signs that biblical prophecy has been unfolding. The first event was the founding of the State of Israel, and the second was the War of 1967, which expanded Israel's borders. Because of the importance of those two events, I want to include some discussion of them. In presenting this talk, then, we'll be covering, one, Christian Zionism and how it's different from Jewish Zionism. They came about for very different reasons. Two, the establishment of the State of Israel. Three, the War of 1967, which expanded Israel's borders. And then we begin the essence of the talk, and you can skip ahead to this next part if you want. And that's the relationship between Prime Minister Menachem Begin and the Reverend Jerry Falwell. Then the belief system called dispensationalism, which is the foundation of modern Christian Zionism. And finally, we'll talk about the settlements in the West Bank and Gaza Strip. So the first half of this tape covers background information about the founding of the State of Israel in the 1967 war, and the second part begins in the year 1978. That's the year that Prime Minister Menachem Begin invited Jerry Falwell to visit Israel. Now we're beginning the first half. There are many different narratives describing the events leading to the founding of the State of Israel and what has happened since. As a speaker, I bring my own history to this subject, so before we jump in, I want to state up front where my sympathies lie. I'm an American Jew who is dedicated to the preservation of the State of Israel existing next to a viable Palestinian state. In 1949, when I was 5 years old, I went with my mother to Stuttgart, Germany, where she was helping Jews in the former Nazi death camp of Bergen-Belsen get into the United States. You see, 4 years after World War II ended, many Jews were still living in the camps. Conditions had improved greatly in what was then called the displaced persons camps, but the residents had no place to go. People living in the displaced persons camps walked around holding up signs with names of relatives in the United States. My mother was helping displaced persons who were still in Bergen-Belsen when one day she saw a woman holding a sign that said the name Pinchas Karl. That's my grandfather. So my mom called her dad as soon as she could get to a phone and asked him if he knew of a young woman named Sprinza. Well, his sister had a daughter named Sprinza, and indeed the woman was my grandfather's niece. Everyone was stunned, as my grandfather assumed that his entire family had been wiped out by the Holocaust. Like many Jews born near the end of World War II, Nazi Germany cast a long shadow over our consciousness. Christian and Jewish Zionism became popular movements for very different reasons. Establishment of the State of Israel was seen by Christian Zionists as fulfillment of God's promise to Abraham. Israel was for early Jewish Zionists a place where Jews would feel safe and could govern themselves. Dr. Theodor Herzl, considered the father of modern Jewish Zionism, was simply reacting to the virulent anti-Semitism in Europe. Jewish immigration to Palestine, having grown slowly in the 1920s, increased substantially beginning in 1933 when Hitler came to power. And there's a reason I'm bringing up this time in history, and it's not to say how much we as a people have suffered or to ask for sympathy. It's just to point out that huge numbers of Jews trying to flee Nazi Germany had no place to go. This history is relevant to understanding how the State of Israel came about. Ships packed primarily with Jewish immigrants desperate to flee Europe couldn't find a port to land in. The St. Louis is one of many boats carrying Jewish refugees out of Europe in 1939. It made it all the way to Havana, Cuba. Of the 936 passengers on board, only 29 were allowed to disembark. The remainder were also barred from entering the United States, so they were forced to return to Europe, where most were murdered in the Holocaust. President Roosevelt, concerned about the problem of Jewish refugees, organized the Avignon Conference in 1938. 38 countries gathered to discuss what to do about the problem of Jewish refugees fleeing Nazi Germany. Out of all the countries represented at the conference, only one agreed to take in a large number of Jewish refugees, and that was the very tiny country of the Dominican Republic. But then World War II broke out, and they were unable to follow through on their promise. Two countries that had plenty of space were Canada and Australia, but they absolutely refused. Ironically, the representative to the Avignon Conference from Australia had just been to England trying to recruit people to emigrate to Australia because the country was so underpopulated. But the Australian representative wouldn't hear of opening immigration to large numbers of Jews. As 6 million Jews were being systematically killed by the Nazis, huge numbers who tried to flee Europe had nowhere to go. So large numbers of refugees started entering British Palestine illegally. As Jewish refugees began flooding into Palestine, tensions grew between the Jewish immigrants and the Palestinian population who lived there. After much fighting, the State of Israel was established in 1948 and accepted into the United Nations in 1949. The establishment of the State of Israel, as I've said before, was seen by Christian Zionists as a sign that God was fulfilling his promise to Abraham. The original 1949 boundaries were not ideal for Israel or for the Palestinians. Many Palestinians lost their homes and land, and Israel was only 9 miles wide at one point in its center, a fact that made it very vulnerable. In a military invasion, the country could be quickly cut in half. Jerusalem was divided, and the ancient biblical lands of Samaria and Judea were left out of Israel's boundaries. But the early Jewish political leaders were pragmatic people. David Ben-Gurion was the founding prime minister of Israel. For him, creation of an independent homeland for Jewish people was necessary for their survival. When Israel was established, Ben-Gurion agreed for practical reasons to accept the boundaries offered to the new Jewish state. From the time of its founding, many of Israel's Arab neighbors threatened to drive it into the sea. By 1967, Israel's neighbors were doing more than just threatening. They were mobilizing for war. Approximately 250,000 troops ringed Israel, along with more than 2,000 tanks and 700 aircraft. On May 16, 1967, the President of Egypt ordered the UN Emergency Force out of the Sinai Desert. On May 22, Egypt closed the Strait of Tehran to all Israeli shipping. This blockade stopped the flow of oil to Israel from its main supplier, Iran, which was basically cutting off Israel's lifeline. So on June 4, 1967, Israel launched a preemptive attack, which it won in just 6 days. At the end of the war, Israel's borders extended all the way to the Jordan River, that included the entire West Bank, all of the Sinai Desert, including the Gaza Strip, and the Golan Heights to the north. For Christian Zionists, this victory was another sign that God was fulfilling his promise to Abraham made 4,000 years ago. The biggest story in the years following the Six-Day War, according to author Timothy Weber in his book called On the Road to Armageddon, was how the Christian Zionists organized to support Israel. now that the Jews were, quote, home in the land of Israel and had expanded beyond its 1948 borders, Christian Zionists became committed to keeping them there. That's the end of the quote from Timothy Weber's book On the Road to Armageddon. Levi Eshkol, Israel's prime minister during the 1967 war, tried to use the newly acquired territories as bargaining chips. Shortly after the war was over, he offered Israel's Arab neighbors the return of nearly all the territories if they would recognize Israel and negotiate a peace. His offer was refused. Eshkol died in 1969, and his successors, concerned about Israel's security, turned a blind eye to settlers moving into the West Bank. The government actually gave the settlers some tacit support by building some infrastructure, which included roads and water. In 1977, settlement activity in the West Bank and Gaza Strip made a quantum leap. Menachem Begin became prime minister that year, and this is where our story really begins. In the first 19 years of the existence of Israel, Begin's ultranationalist notions made him a figure on the fringe. But in 1977, his conservative Likud party had finally broken the political domination of the Labor Party, and Begin became prime minister. Begin had disagreed with the UN boundaries in 1948 and believed the ancient biblical lands of Samaria and Judea in the West Bank of Jordan should be part of the State of Israel. Menachem Begin did something astounding in 1978. He invited Jerry Falwell to visit Israel. The next year, Begin's government gave Falwell his very own Learjet. After Falwell visited Israel, he began leading Christian pilgrimages to the Holy Land, focusing particularly on the biblical lands of Samaria and Judea in the West Bank. Jerry Falwell was interested in the West Bank because he was a dispensationalist. Dispensationalism is a system of theology that divides the entirety of biblical history into seven dispensations, or epochs. The first dispensation is the Garden of Eden. We are now in the sixth dispensation, called Grace. The sixth dispensation began with the birth of Christ and will end with his second coming. The seventh and last dispensation will be the millennium, or 1,000 years, with Christ on earth. So we're at the end of the time of grace, and we're very close to entering the seventh time period, otherwise called the millennial kingdom. That's when Christ returns and rules for 1,000 years. That's why Israel and the settlements are so important. In order to get from the sixth to the seventh dispensation, certain things are supposed to happen. All of the world's Jews are supposed to return to Israel. Then Christ will snatch the true believers away from this world without warning. This is called the rapture, when true believers will join Christ somewhere up in the clouds. The rapture will happen sometime before or during the Great Tribulation, a 7-year time period when the world will witness terrible calamities. And it's not hard to think that, you know, every time there's these horrible hurricanes or tsunamis, just big events, that this is part of the tribulation. The Great Tribulation will culminate in the final battle of Armageddon, which will probably be a nuclear war. After the battle of Armageddon, true believers will return with Christ for 1,000 years of earthly paradise. The Left Behind series, co-authored by the Reverend Tim LaHaye and Jerry Jenkins, is a fictional account of dispensationalism. The wildly popular Left Behind books have sold more than 62 million copies. And what will happen to the Jews in this scenario? 2/3 of them will be wiped out, and the survivors will accept Jesus at last. Israeli author and journalist Gershom Gorenberg, an Orthodox Jew, said on CBS's 60 Minutes, "They," meaning the Christian Zionists, "don't love real Jewish people. They love us as characters in their story and their play, and that's not who we are, and we never auditioned for that part, and the play is not one that ends up good for us. If you listen to the drama they're describing, essentially it's a 5-act play in which the Jews disappear in the 4th act. We're now moving into the final section of this talk, the settlements. The settlements play a key role in the unfolding of biblical prophecy. For Christian Zionists, the settlements support the permanent expansion of Israel's borders into the ancient lands of Samaria and Judea. By supporting the expansion, Christian Zionists are fulfilling God's promise to Abraham. They're also making room for the world's Jews to return. To fulfill biblical prophecy and help bring about the return of Christ, Christian Zionists are encouraging a mass migration of the world's Jews to Israel, and they're also subsidizing settlements. The Gratefully Grafted Ministries is one of the international organizations that supports immigration to Jerusalem and Judea and Samaria in the West Bank. Their ministry sponsors the Ebenezer Emergency Fund and Operation Exodus. The exodus they're talking about is the exodus from the former Soviet Union to populate the settlements. They claim that from 1991 to 2004, they have brought to Israel more than 100,000 Jews. Well, there are approximately 250,000 settlers, so if their number is accurate, then the Eastern European Jews they sponsor could make up as much as 40% of the settlers. Another organization, Christian Friends for Israel, sponsors Operation Aliyah, which they claim is fulfilling biblical prophecy by bringing Jews from the former Soviet Union, Canada, the United States, and South America. John Hagee, pastor of the Cornerstone Church in San Antonio, Texas, announced in February 1997 that his church was donating over $1 million to Israel. Hagee claimed the funds would be used to help resettle Jews from the former Soviet Union in the West Bank and Jerusalem. Christian Friends of Israeli Communities, based in Colorado, is one of the many organizations that runs an Adopt-a-Settlement program. From their website, the focus of Christian Friends of Israeli Communities is to link settlements in Israel with Christian churches and individuals throughout the world. These communities are located in Judea, Samaria, and Gaza. For $25 a month, you can become a partner of Christian Friends of Israeli Communities. For $50 a month, a friend of Biblical Israel. $100 a month, a patron. For $500 a month, a pillar of Biblical Israel. And for $1,000 a month, you can be a guardian of Biblical Israel. Sandra Oster-Barras, an Orthodox Jew, is the director of the Israel Office of Christian Friends of Israeli Communities. She told the San Francisco Chronicle that she estimated one-third of the settlements receive funds from Christians. Some groups give money directly to the settlers. According to the Middle East Information Center, the goal of the Jerusalem prayer team is to raise enough to give a gift of $55 apiece to 14,000 settlers. Donald Wagner, executive director of the Center for Middle Eastern Studies, wrote, "The International Fellowship of Christians and Jews, led by Rabbi Eckstein, claimed to have raised over $5 million, mostly from fundamentalist Christian sources." The late Grace Halsell wrote a book called Prophecy and Politics. It's about her experience on two of Falwell's pilgrimages in the 1980s. Halsell was an author and journalist who served for 3 years as a staff writer for President Lyndon Johnson. In her book, she quotes Charles Fishbein, who was then executive director of the Jewish National Fund. He worked with the American Christian Trust. Fishbein told Halsell that the American Christian Trust planned to raise $100 million to purchase land for Jewish settlements in the West Bank, the target area being in the Palestinian town of Hebron. Well, that was back in the 1980s. I actually called Charles Fishbein to verify this story, and he said that it was all true. He had worked closely with a Mrs. Bobby Romas of the American Christian Trust, who raised huge amounts of tax-exempt dollars, and then she sent the money to the Christian Embassy in Jerusalem to buy up land in the West Bank, primarily in the area of Hebron. Hebron is a very interesting city. It's a Palestinian city of about 150,000 people. At the center of Hebron is a Jewish settlement of some 800 residents, guarded by about 1,500 Israeli soldiers, who are in turn surrounded by a sea of hostility. David Wilder, spokesperson for the Jews of Hebron, said in an interview for a PBS documentary, "You have to understand Hebron to the Jewish people. Hebron is the first Jewish city in the land of Israel, and this is where Abraham lived, and this is where King David lived. The Tomb of the Patriarchs makes Hebron the second holiest site in Judaism after Jerusalem. Revered by Muslims as well as Jews, the tomb is where Abraham and Sarah are said to be buried, along with Rachel, Jacob, Leah, even Adam and Eve. Another settlement in the West Bank, Ariel, has become a small Jewish city with more than 20,000 settlers. Bill Moyers, PBS television series Now, visited Ariel and interviewed many of its members. They were surprised to find living there some Christian Zionists who had come from Waco, Texas. Lawrence Schaefer, a Jewish businessman living in Ariel, told Bill Moyers Now, "There's a lot of people in the outside world that think that we all live here because we're all very right-wing fanatics. No. We're people who do not have enough money to afford to buy a flat. But we want to leave something to our children. And to buy a house inside inland Israel costs 3 times what it costs in Ariel." The Christian Science Monitor wrote a story about Ariel in 1988. 5 years ago, it said, Ariel was a town in the doldrums, laying the groundwork for making peace with the Palestinians. Then Prime Minister Yitzhak Rabin had frozen building plans and cut off preferential funding to Jewish settlements like this one on land Israel occupied in 1967. Depression set in here as the settlers came to be seen as peace's spoilers and began to fear for their settlement's future. Then came faith. Faith Bible Chapel, that is, in Aurora, Colorado, an evangelical church whose members made it their mission to adopt Ariel. Faith Bible Chapel gives this settlement about $100,000 each year, much of it raised from selling Christmas fruit baskets. These stories raise the question of how many settlements would still be there without financial support from Christian Zionists. Israeli journalist Akiva Elder said on Bill Moyers Now, "Christian Zionists are pouring money into Israel, but that's not the only way they are supporting Israeli settlement of the West Bank. The most important thing is that they have so much influence in Washington, that they are so influential in the White House and in Congress." Jerry Falwell told 60 Minutes, "There are 70 million of us. I don't know how accurate that number is. That may be high, but the number of dispensationalists is substantial. A CNN Time poll found that about 59% of Americans believe in some form of dispensationalism." Anyway, back to Falwell. So he said, "There are 70 million of us. And if there's one thing that brings us together quickly, it's whenever we begin to detect our government becoming a little anti-Israel." What does he mean by a little anti-Israel? A little anti-Israel means any efforts to dismantle the settlements. When the Bush administration called on Israel to stop its April 2002 military offensive in the West Bank, the White House received over 100,000 emails from Christian Zionists in protest. Almost immediately, President Bush came to Israel's defense. What happened in Congress around that time was even more revealing. Over the objections of the State Department, the Republican-led Congress adopted resolutions supporting Israel's actions and blaming the violence exclusively on the Palestinians. This congressional resolution reflects the fact that some members of Congress are dispensationalists, including the powerful House Majority Leader Tom DeLay, Republican of Texas. He strongly opposes land concessions in the West Bank, and according to a biography called The Hammer, he believes in the power of the coming millennium of Jesus Christ. When Bush announced his roadmap for Middle East peace, the White House received more than 50,000 postcards over the next 2 weeks from Christian Zionists opposing any plan that called for the establishment of a Palestinian state. The administration quickly backpedaled, and the once highly touted roadmap essentially died during the rest of the president's first term. Now, during his second term, the roadmap appears to be revived. On April 15, 2004, President Bush made a major departure from American policy in the Middle East. He endorsed Israeli sovereignty over parts of the West Bank in exchange for Israel's disengagement from the Gaza Strip. The New York Times called this endorsement a costly blow to America's credibility as an honest broker for a Middle East peace. An interesting event preceded the president's endorsement of the Sharon plan. According to the Village Voice, in May of 2004, a meeting took place between Elliot Abrams, Director of Near East and North African Affairs for the National Security Council, and the Apostolic Congress. The Apostolic Congress is conducting a one-state solution campaign. That means that one state, Israel, should occupy the entire West Bank and Gaza Strip. For a little background, in June of 2001, Pastor Upton, head of the Apostolic Congress, attended a White House briefing. "From that moment," Pastor Upton wrote, he realized that his organization had real political power. Here's a direct quote from their website about their relationship with the Bush White House. "Christians are affecting policy in Washington. We keep America's Christian leaders informed about their role with the current administration through regular White House briefings." So the White House sent Elliot Abrams to meet with the Apostolic Congress to discuss the Sharon plan to pull out of the Gaza Strip. Abrams explained to them that the Gaza Strip had no biblical significance. Their theological concerns must have been satisfied, because 3 weeks after Elliot Abrams met with the Apostolic Congress, President Bush endorsed the Sharon plan to withdraw from Gaza. Prime Minister Ariel Sharon was the architect of the settlements. As Prime Minister Menachem Begin's Secretary of Agriculture, Sharon placed the settlements in strategic locations to enhance Israel's security. Settlements were built on hilltops where they can see invaders approaching and shoot down at tanks. At some point much later in his career, Sharon realized the settlements were actually hurting Israel's security, and he proposed the plan to unilaterally pull out of the Gaza Strip and withdraw some outposts in the West Bank. Israel's parliament approved Sharon's plan to dismantle the Jewish settlements in Gaza, and the reaction has been a well-organized and very vocal minority who are threatening to fight the pullout. Jewish settlers of faith are afraid that Gaza is just the beginning and that the West Bank will come next. Ironically, Palestinians are afraid of the opposite, that Sharon will stop with Gaza and increase Israel's presence in the West Bank. So the protesters fear the Gaza pullout is a first step, and the Palestinians fear it's a last step. To heat up matters, militant Jewish settlers of faith are threatening a civil war inside Israel, and Palestinians have translated the film Gandhi into Arabic. The film is being shown to Palestinians, so it appears that they're gearing up for massive civil disobedience, which could be far more effective than suicide bombers. This is April 2005, and the only certainty right now is that by the time this talk is heard, that part of the world will be different than this moment in time when I'm making this recording. A survey released by the organization Peace Now in August 2003 indicates that more than 70% of the settlers, that's a significant increase from previous polls, would agree to leave the West Bank and Gaza if they were compensated. There is a window of opportunity right now to resolve the tensions between Israelis and Palestinians, and it appears that the political will is there. Since the death of Arafat, Mahmoud Abbas, the prime minister of the Palestinian Authority, seems interested in negotiating a settlement, as does Israel's prime minister, Ariel Sharon. Both leaders have to deal with the radical and violent elements of their own societies. Apparently, to strengthen his coalition and minimize violence, Sharon announced a plan to build 3,600 new homes in Maal Adumim, a settlement of 30,000 people just 4.5 miles east of Jerusalem. This plan is very unfortunate, as it will further cut off the Arabs of East Jerusalem from the rest of the West Bank and sends the wrong signal at the wrong time. The peace process is fragile and literally full of landmines. The Christian Zionists represent a major hurdle to the peace process, and I doubt they'll sit quietly on the sidelines. They have so much at stake. But I almost never hear them mentioned in the news. There needs to be sustained exposure to the activities of the Christian Zionists, both inside and outside of Israel. Jerry Falwell said to 60 Minutes, "The Bible Belt is Israel's only safety belt right now." In fact, the opposite is true. The settlements that the Bible Belt has poured so much money into are actually endangering the Jewish state. The world is reacting strongly to Israel's presence in the West Bank, and a worldwide divestment movement is growing. Divestment means to take your money out of a place. For example, on July 2, 2004, the Presbyterian Church USA agreed to consider taking its money out of holdings or multinational corporations doing business in Israel. The Presbyterian Church USA has nearly 3 million U.S. members and an estimated $7 billion in combined pension fund and foundation assets. On February 21st, the World Council of Churches urged its 347-member denominations to give serious consideration to pulling investments out of Israel. Divestment campaigns are underway in universities all across the country. So Falwell says the Bible Belt is Israel's only safety belt right now. I'm suggesting that Christian Zionists, in their passion to permanently expand Israel's borders, are managing to turn much of the world against Israel. Then Falwell's statement becomes a self-fulfilling prophecy. This is what's happening. Christian Zionists support Jewish immigration to the settlements in the West Bank and Gaza. They subsidize the settlements, and they lobby Washington to support them. The world gets angry at what they see as an illegal occupation of Palestinian territories. And then Falwell has the chutzpah to say, "Join us, we're Israel's only safety valve." I want to close with a story about David Ben-Gurion, Israel's founding prime minister. Arthur Hertzberg, an American Jewish scholar, was in Israel just after the Six-Day War. He was caught up in the euphoria that Jews all over the world were feeling when he heard David Ben-Gurion make an extraordinary speech. Hertzberg wrote about Ben-Gurion's speech in an article for the New York Review of Books. It's titled "The Tragedy of Victory." Ben-Gurion was, by this time, a very old man, retired to his kibbutz in the Negev Desert. Hertzberg wrote, "The Ben-Gurion who walked into the meeting had about him the air of a prophet who had walked out of his tent to die, but had paused on this last journey to tell us truths which the less far-sighted could not see and which only a man possessed by the Spirit would dare tell." He warned his listeners against the euphoria that had swept the Jewish world in the aftermath of the Six-Day War. Ben-Gurion insisted that all of the territories that had been captured had to be given back very quickly, for holding on to them would distort and might ultimately destroy the Jewish state. That's from The Tragedy of Victory by Arthur Hertzberg, and this is Joan Beaucaire for Theocracy Watch, April 18, 2005.
For more information on Theocracy Watch, please visit theocracywatch.org. This program was produced by Carl Fitzke at Soundswell Studio, Ithaca, New York, USA. For more information on Soundswell, please visit soundswellstudio.com. Thank you.